With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Välkomna till Rock Bottom. Och idag så kommer vi prata engelska igen. We could actually speak Swedish because
we
you're...
We could try.
Yeah, let's not.
No, I think for an international audience and a broader listening, let's do it in English.
Yeah, and most, I mean, our listeners are mostly Swedish, but then again, everyone in Swedish speaks
yes,
English.
Yes, yeah.
Welcome, Tim Russell.
Thank you very much.
Studio guru, engineer, tech, producer. How would you present yourself to someone?
All of the above. Nowadays, yeah. Trying to make films and documentaries and stuff as well. But all music related. It's all good.
And you're half Swedish.
No,
But you were brought up in Sweden.
I grew up as a teenager. Well, from 5 to 24, 25 here. So I learned music and I learned all about music here.
So that's why your career has been going so well.
Yes. No, actually, it was very... What it taught me over here is that in the 70s, in the early 70s, we were so glad when anybody showed up. It didn't matter what sort of music they were playing, whether it was rock or, I don't know, soul or something, reggae. Mm-hmm. You went to see them because you were just so glad anyone had come all the way to Stockholm.
Yeah.
You know, but it was crazy because you'd find yourself going to see Nazareth one day, then, you know, next week you'd go and see Elton John, then you'd go and see The Shadows.
But so all your musical background, everything started out
Bob Marley,
here in Stockholm.
All that sort of stuff. Yeah. In terms of experiences and listening to music and so on, you know.
So how come you ended up living here? Your parents moved
My dad was moved here on business and so on, and they're still here. Or at least my mom is still here. My dad's dead now. But yeah, so yeah. We came in 1965, and it's gone on from there. I was 4 years old, and... So, yeah, my, you know, all the best years of your life, as some people like to say, the teenage years were done here, so.
So what shows did you get to see here in Stockholm back in those days?
I still say the best show ever. All these years later, I still say that, and that was Rainbow 76, the Rainbow Rising tour with Dio and Blackmore and so on, with Richie Blackmore out to prove that Deep Purple were a bunch of crap at that time with their Come Taste a Band. They're going, oh, funk, this is rock, this is heavy. And at Konserthuset.
Which was a really good venue.
Except it's all seating. But if you really want to know, it's also one of the loudest concerts I ever went to. And though I was 11 rows back in front of Richie, the kids in the first 3 rows, the moment he hit a chord, they were knocked unconscious.
Really?
And they were being dragged out of the side doors by security, and you could see them. They'd come out and they'd wake up and go, why am I out here? And they'd run back in before anybody could stop them, and he'd hit another chord and down they'd go.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. My ears rang for 6 days after that.
Was it worth it, though?
Absolutely. As I said, I still hold it as the best show I've ever seen. Only because you had such high expectations and they were blown away. Normally, if you have high expectations, you're disappointed. Mm-hmm. But this was like I had high and it blew them away. I'm going, wow. I just remember the concert coming to an end, everybody going, what, finished already? And then you looked at your watch going, wow. I've never seen 120 minutes go so fast. But that's cool, you know.
Yeah. Was that something that made you you know, want to be in the music business, or have you decided that already, or did that come later?
No. That came a lot later. I mean, I've always wanted to do something, but I don't consider myself a great musician. There are plenty better around me, and I'd rather listen to them rather than force someone to listen to my rubbish playing, or at least I think it's rubbish. So I decided to get into the technical side, but that was 1985, I suppose, 86, mm-hmm. when I was living in Los Angeles, doing something completely different. I was designing fruit drinks for Sunkist Fruit Drinks. That's something
that is something completely different,
but it's still creative.
It is, you know? Absolutely,
it's still creative. And I used to do something similar at Marabu over here before that, which is how I ended up there.
The chocolate company.
Oh yes,
yeah.
But my dad worked for a chocolate company as well, which is how I got to know Marabu, and we also distributed the orange drinks, which are Sunkist. I got to know them, so it's all. Psh.
And how did you get out of the family rut of being in
sweet
business?
It was a rut because, you know, there were expectations. You know, you should follow in your father's footsteps. It's like, Dad, I know the job, but, you know, it doesn't excite me. You know, I mean, I'm going to be fat and bald and everything by the age I'm 25 if I do that. I didn't want to do that. So, no, I was in Los Angeles, and as has been most of my life, wherever I go to a bar, within 5 minutes, I'm talking to all the musicians in the room.
And 85, then, by that time, that was, you know, the glam rock and
it was. Yeah, and in fact, not quite, because, I mean, we did play some gigs, and I used to play, I'd be invited on stage by some local bands as our friend from London, England, which was cool, do a couple of songs. But, I mean, all the sort of poodle stuff that everyone goes on about from that time was really even underground then.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't come across it as much as I thought I might. It would be 2 years later that it really sort of exploded more into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
But it was out there. I decided that, okay, I'm not going to... I was helping out some guys doing live sound, and I just thought, this is a hell of a lot of hassle. Plus, I don't get to enjoy the show. I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to enjoy a show when I get to it. So if we're going to do that, let's see if we can do it in a studio. And in those days, there were no things like courses and degrees and all that sort of stuff to get into all the technical sides. You knocked on a door and you said, hi, you got a job? And because my visa in the States was specifically for designing fruit drinks, to get a job as in a studio would require another one. I said, you know what? Screw that. Let me go to London.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm English, so I don't need any work permits. And I made a list of the 6 top studios where all my favorite records have been made. And I said, there was Air Studios, Abbey Road.
Of course.
Olympic with Rolling Stones and all of that sort of stuff. There was Townhouse, Trident Studios, and Psalm.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the 6, I decided, let's try those. If I don't get into those, I'm going to give it 6 months, then screw it, I'll go back to designing food.
Okay.
And it's one of those classic things where I got an interview at Trident, and they said, we really love you. I got one more interview today, but I think you've got the job. I got home, phone rang, sorry, the other guy's got way more experience and you don't have any.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough, but we'll keep you on our list. 3 weeks later, they phoned back. They said, you still free? I go, yeah. They said, because the guy we hired was crap.
lucky you then.
Still want to work here? Can you start tomorrow? I go, not really. They go, why not? I said, well, I got a ZZ Top concert on tonight. On that night. They said, oh, well, I can start in the morning after. They said, that's cool. You know, that's a good excuse. We'll buy that excuse. So, you know, went to see ZZ Top and started at Trident Studios the next morning.
And what was your first project there, you remember?
The first things that were there when I was in a band called Big Audio Dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
Hugh Masekela was in as well. There were 3 studios in the building, or 2 in that building and 1 in an annex studio. Cannot remember who was in the annex studio, but...
You work with some pretty impressive names in my kind of genre, or the podcast kind of genre, though.
Yeah,
Gary Moore, for example.
Yeah, he
and we're going to play a song here with... you actually worked on this album, I think, Over the Hills and Far Away.
Yes.
Yeah, let's listen to that. Gary Moore.
Still had been found.
We're back. That was Gary Moore. And tell us about when you worked with him on this song.
Well, as I say, this was only about 3 weeks into me starting there as a sort of assistant and gopher and runner and general whatever, dog's body. And he came in. They came in to do all the acoustic overdubs for that album, the string sections, the acoustic guitars, and all the sort of more lightweight stuff, if you will, but the production stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just remember being asked to go down. They said, oh, Gary wants, you know, can you sort Gary out a cup of tea or coffee or whatever he wants? And I went down into the main studio, and he was just sitting there on his own with his acoustic guitar working out some parts. And I brought him his tea, and he said, what are you doing now? He said, well, right now, nothing. He said, sit down. So I sat down on the floor, cross-legged in front of me, and he spent the next 90 minutes playing stuff to me, going, what do you think of this? Do you like this better than that? And I'm just the guy who's just begun. There are producers and everyone else who I thought he should be asking those questions to. But you know what? it was so wonderful to be taken seriously, and he was such a really nice guy and so on. He's just like, no.
And also, maybe you represent the fans in a better way, because you're not jaded.
Yeah, no, well, absolutely. I would like to think that. Well, no, in general, because, I mean, my passion is still going out to concerts and seeing the real deal rather than what we create in studios, mm-hmm. which can't, I mean, everyone wants to capture a live vibe in a studio, but you never can because there's no audience. And musicians feed off an audience rather than a couple of guys behind a glass window sort of looking kind of bored and going, yeah, can you do it again, please? You know, we'll keep that if you insist, but I'd like you to do one more. Take 75, you know.
And still, you buy it every time someone says, oh, that was really, really good. Can you do it again? I'm like, yeah, sure.
No, then you haven't worked with me. I go, come on. You think I'm supposed to be impressed by that? I've seen it. You can do much better than that. Do it again.
Well, give we're not the talking challenge. About my drinking skills over here now.
No. Maybe in another life. Yeah.
So working with all these famous people, you work with, you come across, I mean, both people that have been really super nice to you, but also had there been some assholes along the way?
Do you know what? Not as many as people imagine. There's always assholes in any business. Mm-hmm. I just think I'm quite good with people due to what other jobs I did before, the ones we already talked about. And I love music, and I think that comes across.
Probably, yeah.
And I've worked with people who other people have warned me, like, oh, he's an asshole or she's an asshole. Be careful, or you're going to have a nightmare with them. And you know what? I never have.
No.
But then you're working with someone, and then you think about the person who told you that, and you think, oh, yeah, personality clash. Mm-hmm. That's why they didn't get on and so on. But I don't know. I very, very seldom ever had that happen. And the assholes, to be honest, are always the youngest kids who've just got signed or whatever, who really have egos that can't get through doors mm-hmm. unless they turn sideways and stuff like that. And they also, if something goes wrong, and you know, in studios, stuff occasionally does go wrong. Technically, it breaks down, and they're mm-hmm. the ones that panic like crazy, and they think you're trying to sabotage their project and all sorts of crazy accusations. But an old band will, they'll go, okay, how long will it take to fix? We'll go around the pub. Come and get us when it's done. You know, it's a whole different attitude. They know that stuff happens. They know nobody's trying to sabotage their career or anything stupid like that. So, no, the young kids are the hardest ones because they have, but they don't really know how the whole thing works.
Let's listen to a really nice band, a bunch of really nice guys from Sweden. And you worked on this album. This is honestly, my favorite song ever with this band. Let's listen to Electric Boys and Ready to Believe.
Are you ready to believe? Are you ready to believe? Are you ready to believe? Yeah.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast. Alongside my good friend, John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
That was the Electric Boys from Sweden. I love this song. It's such a great album.
I think so too. And I'd have to say that what I like about their new album is that it sounds almost like it could have been made about the same time. It's heavier mm-hmm. than the other stuff and more yep. in line. Because Freewheeling was, certainly at the time, just a straight out rock album. It
Absolutely.
Wasn't kind of funky rock or anything like that.
No.
It was just a straight rock album. And that particular song, I agree. I love that song. I think it's great. I think the mixes came out great. And it was crazy as well because the producer was Andy Scarth. And, I mean, I could tell you all sorts of stories about this session. But basically, when it came to mixing, we'd run out of time and they'd run out of money. Oh. And we had a Christmas deadline to meet. And so we went to the studio called Swan Yard. And we decided to split the mixes into two separate rooms. And you couldn't get two more different rooms in terms of sound. So what we said is, you start one and I'll start one. And halfway through, we'll cross. And I'll take over yours and you take over mine.
Oh.
And then we'll come back and just check that we're happy that that's kind of sounding the way yeah. we both thought it would do. Because otherwise, you know how different rooms can sound different. Mm-hmm. You get different sounding mixes to counterbalance that. If we keep changing halfway through each mix, we should kind of get a good balance and all of that.
That's a daring move.
It's a daring move, but it's also when you've got to mix an album in 6 days and so on. And
turned out great.
Yeah. My boss at my proper studio almost fired me because I told him I'd gone on a holiday for Christmas at that point a week early. And instead, I went to this other studio, Swan Yard, to do that. And he didn't know until the album came out and they got sent a copy. And then I got called up to the office and he's holding a copy of this album. What the hell's all this about? Why were you working at another studio? Because when you're on contract to studios, they do not like you doing that sort of thing unless they've given the okay.
I understand. Hell, what can you
it
do?
It is what it is. It came out good. So,
yeah, came out great.
You know.
What about Lemmy?
Well, Lemmy.
We
have to talk about Lemmy. And as I suddenly realized, actually, you know, I never knew him that well. But Trident Studios was right in the middle of Soho.
Mm-hmm.
And across the road, or just around the corner, about 100 meters away, there was a rock club called the San Moritz Club.
Mm-hmm.
And the San Moritz Club, many people call Lemmy's London office.
Okay.
But it was also because Trident didn't really have a proper lounge for all the artists from the different studios. You know, we'd send them around there, and they'll hang there, and we'll come and get them and hope they're not too drunk when we pull them out to do something. And any rock band that was in town was down there, and so, and Lemmy was almost always down there. And occasionally pop around to the studio at 3 a.m, you know, before going home just to see who was there and what was going on. And I was only the assistant on a project, and I cannot for the life of me remember what it was. It wasn't important, but there was a young producer, and the front doorbell rang, and a few minutes later in walked Lemmy. And everybody's, you know, the young band is sitting there going, oh God, it's Lemmy, oh. And the producer's like, shit, it's Lemmy. And I'm like, hi, Lemmy. And he didn't like me because I'd often won all the money he used to put in the one-armed bandits. Right after he walked away, I'd put in a coin and get £300. I'd turn around, you bastard, not again, man, that's my money. Well, it's mine now, mate. However, back to the studio. And Lemmy came in, and there was a take going on, and he stood on the other side of the mixing console, and he stared at this young producer guy who was already going, oh, I'm a bit nervous. And he suddenly goes, no, that's a terrible take. Do it again. And the producer's like, on the talk back, do it again, do it again. Lemmy says so, and Lemmy gives another couple of things. You should do it like this, you should do it like that. The producer's like, do it like this, do it like that. And then Lemmy explodes. He just turns on this kid and says, what the fuck are you doing? I don't know if I can say fuck on your program. I just did.
Well, you can.
But he explodes. Anything goes here. He explodes at this young guy. And he said, why the hell are you listening to me? I'm not on your session. I'm not part of your session. I just walked in. And now you're taking all your direction from me? Don't ever do that. It's your show. You're in charge. If anything, you should kick me out.
Wow.
And that was a great lesson.
Oh, yeah.
In as much as that's absolutely right. And this poor little kid didn't know whether he should kick him out or not, but he didn't. But Lemmy just said, no, 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 I'm gone. But learn that lesson. And I thought to myself sitting there, I'm going, you know what? That's probably the best lesson you can ever learn in terms of production and other things. Because you know that you get all sorts of guests and visitors during sessions and some try and interfere, shall we say, and others don't. And so on. So, but that was a good lesson from Lemmy kind of thing. And then we just see him all the time down at the San Moritz Club and, you know, have beers and so on at 3 a.m. before it closed and stuff. But, yeah, cool guy. And I know his son as well a little bit, Paul, who had a great excuse for being late for a session once. He was supposed to do an overdub on a couple of tracks and we're waiting for him and go, why is he late? Well, he's usually pretty punctual. And he finally comes in all dripping with sweat going, I'm sorry I'm late. Oh, so where were you? He said, well, my dad was playing the Academy in Brixton and I always joined him for Ace of Spades to do one of the solos. And he said, literally, I knew I was on my way here, but I had to stop off and do that. And he said, literally jumped out of the taxi, ran onto the stage with my guitar, plugged it in, played the solo, waved at Dad, ran off the other side of the stage, and now I'm here to work with you. And I thought, that's cool. I'll buy that as an excuse.
That's pretty cool night visiting Dad at work.
For 30 seconds.
Yeah. You work with Adrian Smith from Our Maintenance?
Yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the fun thing was about this, it was an album that became the ASAP Adrian Smith and Project, and it was his first solo album. And though some of what we did ended up on the final album, it's a long story, but my ex-boss at that time was scheduled to produce it, but they didn't like him. It was contractual. They didn't have a choice. But they decided that they would actually do all the demos with us, and we spent 6.5-7 weeks demoing on the most expensive amount of money I've ever seen spent on demos. And Adrian was paying for the lot, so it was his session. And we just told him, you know, you don't have to work with that guy. You will, but we can do all the stuff you need to do here. And we did from scratch. And we had Nico was also on the drums on that. He didn't end up doing the final album. Yes, of course. And Adrian and two other guitarists, Dave Bucket Colwell, who's in Humble Pie, still is. He's touring the States with Humble Pie now. And a guy called Andy Barnett, who actually lives in Umeå these days with his Swedish woman. And but him, two other phenomenal guitarists and Adrian. I wish I could, I had copies. I think I have one or two of the mixes we did with real three guitar rock, in your face rock. Sadly, the final album with my ex-boss producing it, I wasn't part of that. Sounds like it's all keyboards. It's like, what? Because he had a programmer guy, and you know, in the 80s, that programming was becoming the thing. And you know, Europe and a whole bunch of other bands have very synthy bass songs and stuff like that. And he decided that was the way to go with that. And we're just like, oh my God, what have you done? I mean, we understood it as, you know, keyboards in the background, few pads here and there, three guitars in your face.
Wow.
And instead it came out as something else. And I'm really sad for Adrian that he did. I mean, it did okay. It gave him confidence and stuff. But what sweet, lovely guy. Nico as well. I mean, they're all lovely guys. Dave Murray was hanging out as well. And it was just a good old-fashioned rock and roll let's have fun, no pressure.
Mm-hmm.
6.5 weeks of fun. I mean, we had Adrian's engagement party to his wife, who's still married to Natalie, we did there, and all sorts of things. And yeah, I mean, we could talk about things that I probably shouldn't talk about live. And, though I don't think anybody would deny them, they might not want to hear them.
Well, let's listen to...
You'll have to read my book someday.
Yeah, definitely.
It's all in there.
Let's listen to another song that made an impression on you. That was Little Angels, and that's 10 Miles High?
Yeah.
This song then, Little Angels, 10 Miles High.
Well, the reason I actually chose to work on that, I was scheduled to do something else, but they were being produced by Mike Fraser. And Mike Fraser, he works with Thunder, he's working with AC/DC right now.
Yeah, he even crossed my path for a minute.
Yeah, he's a Canadian guy, but he had a great reputation. And like anybody learning any job, the best people to learn from are the experts.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew of him and I saw he was in and I said, no, I want to work on that.
Mm-hmm.
They had to do a bit of juggling, but I was, you know, one of the senior guys at this other studio, and so I got to do that. And we did a whole bunch of tracks, but which I thought were going to go on an album, but it turned out that's the only one they used, and I don't even think it's on an album. I think it just came out as a single.
Oh.
I may be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But he taught me all sorts of crazy miking techniques and other things I'd never seen before and had weird concepts to like make every control room sound the same wherever he was. And he had a case full of big flags for like festivals and things like that. And he's a big motorbiker guy. And he just hung all these flags hanging all over the room, so many of them. You're going, isn't this messing with the sound? He goes, yeah, but it messes with the sound in every room in the same way.
Oh.
And I thought, wow, actually, that's a pretty cool concept. Mm-hmm. I mean, most
people... And it's cozy.
And it's cozy, and it looks cool, yeah. too, you know? But that, and a whole bunch of other things I'd never seen anyone else do. And so, you know, I felt I walked out of that. Not only was it, were the guys good fun and so on, but it was a great learning experience when you really do learn new things as opposed to just seeing the same old things recycled. And because everything's about what do they do that no one else does? What makes them special?
What advice would you give to someone starting out as an engineer or producer to get into the business or, you know, finding their own sound and way to work and...
I'd have to say that...
Finding their unique selling point, as we say nowadays.
Yeah. I mean, I think the real... To me, the real thing that's gone missing now is most of the big studios with multi-rooms and so on have disappeared. And the bonus of working in places like that is you had a huge turnover of people and a huge turnover of artists. So you got the opportunity to work with hell of a lot of different people, loads and loads of different people from all sorts of backgrounds. And as I said, everybody's got their own technique. No two people are the same. Today, everybody does a course at school where they learn the same thing. Everybody learns the same thing. And then they go and do their own thing. And they don't get the chance to learn from all these other producers or engineers or other thing and pick up techniques.
They Google it instead, perhaps?
Or they watch on YouTube. Don't do that, kids. Go actually out there and learn it. There's so much rubbish on YouTube. I mean, my mind boggles when I see kids say, I saw this thing on YouTube. They say do something like this or that. And you go, what? But... No, there's no substitute for experience, and I think that goes for any job. And the better people you can work with, the better it is for you. Having said that, you can suddenly find yourself working with somebody who has a big name, and you walk out and go, is that all he does? I mean, I know people that have worked with some serious producers and so on and come back to me and go, I was so disappointed. You know, all that guy did is sit at the back of the room and smoke weed, you know? And there's a classic example of that, just as to how people perceive producers and engineers. There's an interview to do with the Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run album. On the DVD, 30th anniversary, they had a DVD with it about all the recording of the album and stuff like that. And they have an interview at the end with both Bruce Springsteen and Steve Van Zandt. And Bruce Springsteen is going on and on about how he couldn't have done the album without this producer, he couldn't have done this. That guy was so important, absolutely crucial to everything. Without him, there would have never been an album. Steve Van Zandt asked the same question. He goes, I haven't a fucking clue what he did. I don't even know why he was there. So, you know.
Well, it probably made the boss feel comfortable.
Sometimes that's all that's necessary. Yep. And sometimes it is just that.
Or maybe he just brought some really good weed to the studio. Who knows?
I think there might have been a little bit more of that to it as well, or something else. But yes, sometimes that can be the case. But in those days, the A&R men provided all of that.
Oh, yeah.
They'd come in at 10 in the morning and put a large bag of something on the mixing console and say, will that do for the day?
Yeah.
See you tomorrow.
Oh, God, I remember those days when the record companies had money.
Yeah. I mean, the scary thing is I don't think for the first 5 or 6 years I ever worked on a project that didn't have at least £1 million budget. Try and ask anybody if they've had £1 million budget in the last 20 years.
No, and certainly not like $10,000 a week on extras.
Well,
when we all know where that
they end up having to earn that money back. Yeah. I mean, that's the difference too. In those days, you could earn it back. These days,
No, or you could get a contract that said non-recoupable.
Well, I mean, as they say, and the nice thing about non-recoupables is the fact that they didn't require receipts. Around 1990-91, the accountants started taking over, and they wanted receipts for everything.
Yep.
And certain things don't come with receipts.
Nope.
At least not for what you think they do. Can we have 20 sandwiches for me today? I'll have to bill it as that. No, I mean, those days were a lot of fun as well, just because of that. I mean, people get the wrong impression that, oh, maybe we just did that all the time and so on. And no, you don't. You've got a job to do.
Yeah, absolutely. What I think it's just as much fun nowadays, because I think it's more of a democratic way of working. You can get to see a lot of new bands on YouTube or whatever. So there's a lot of crap that comes up, obviously. But there's also a lot of great bands that get a chance to, like, build their own careers through with no money and just because they're really good at promoting themselves. And I think that's really, really nice and really cool. So, I mean, yeah, I'm not the one that says, oh, I love the better fur or something like that.
Yeah,
no.
I mean, I understand completely where you're coming from, and I think in many ways it is a good thing, but like selling anything, ultimately, it's your promotion that costs money. Mm-hmm. The more promotion, the more chance you have. It's not a guarantee in any way, shape, or form, but it helps. And when you have £500,000 in marketing...
Of course.
And, you know, when all the kids around 2000 started saying, oh, we don't need record companies, they're the devil, they're ripping us all off. We'll do it ourselves. What they didn't realize is the amount of money the record companies put into promotion and all the contacts they had and all the radio stations and TV stations and all that would guarantee that your face was in everyone's face.
I mean, getting a great Instagram account won't make you a rock star. No.
Sadly not. Yeah, no, sadly not. You got to have one, though.
Yeah.
But
do you still go out to see a lot of bands?
I think you know the answer to that.
Well,
but for the listeners, I was just counting, I mean, because the other day at Easter, I went down to England to see Burning Rain with Doug Aldridge and Keith St. John, who ironically I'd only seen the week before in London anyhow. But hey, what else are you going to do on Easter Day?
Yeah.
But no, I was looking because as of last year, I started keeping track of who I go and see and what I go and see. Last year, I think I saw about 280 bands. This year already I've seen 92 performances. Some bands I've seen two or three times, but basically a good 80 bands I've seen already this year. So
what's the best this year so far?
I have to get my list out.
Yeah.
Pause that for a second. I don't know if I can get it in here. I don't have internet. But good bands this year. Writer's Creed. I like Bad Touch. They're both kind of a little bit more southern rock rather than hard rock, but they're pretty rocking. I enjoyed a Swedish band recently, a couple of weeks ago, Hexed, Uppsala band. This girl I like, Beth Blade and the Beautiful Disasters, who were on the Kiss cruise last year with Thunder Mother and all the other bands like that.
So if you would...
I'm trying to think of bands that fit your listeners rather than us, because there are others as well, but you might go, you know. And funnily enough, what I'm enjoying is all these guys going out and doing acoustic tours and so on, where you get stuff, you know, done in a way you've
like
not heard it done.
Like established bands like...
Yeah, yeah, like Doug Aldrich from Dead Daisies and Whitesnake, sort of, you know, sitting there 2 feet in front of you playing an acoustic guitar. That's cool.
Yeah.
You know, all of that sort of stuff. I'm open to things being done differently because I get very upset. And I was just discussing this yesterday with people who say, oh, I don't like going to concerts because they don't play it just like the record.
Oh.
And I've come across that more and more. Oh, well, I think so, but they don't. And they get disappointed if they go and somebody to see their favorite artist and the artist has changed the solo in the song or done a slightly different arrangement. They walk out going, well, it's not like the record. I paid to go and see the record.
I can see somewhat of a point in that, because sometimes when you see
bollocks,
a band...
No, sit at home and listen to the record then.
Sometimes you listen to your favorite song, and then you go see the concert, and it sounds nothing like your favorite song, because the band is bored from playing it the same way.
They've got to keep themselves excited.
Just keeps wailing. But I think that's sort of a finger in the face for the audience. I mean, of course it shouldn't sound like exactly on the album, because that's super boring. But to do, you know, a reggae version of a metal song, that's not fair to the audience. I don't think so. Just because you're bored. The audience isn't bored. They haven't heard that song live yet.
You hope so. No, but on that case, I mean, actually Burning Rain in London a couple of weeks back, they had a young kid supporting one of the support bands. I think it's some Polish kid. Name's kind of irrelevant because I can't even pronounce it or remember it properly. But he was doing covers, and he was doing covers of Black Sabbath and Deep Purple and Ozzy Osbourne and acoustic, but like stoner acoustic. So, I mean, he'd announced this next song as like Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath. And you're going, did he say Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath? Couldn't have done. I just thought it was a mumble. But then he's playing along and there's this really laid back acoustic stuff. And suddenly you start listening to it, gets to the chorus, and you go, my God, it is. Uh-huh. You know? And to me, I think that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing years ago, seeing Eric Clapton, this is in the 70s, and he managed to get to the chorus of Layla without anybody realizing the song was Layla.
Well, okay, so that's pretty cool.
that's pretty amazing to be able to do that. And everybody goes, my God.
I have to agree with that.
You know?
Well, thank you so much, Tim, for visiting me here at Rock Bottom.
And it's my pleasure. I mean, this has been fun, man. You know I could talk for forever, but...
we'll have to get back
to
you
someday. Hey, I'm trying to get a book published, if anybody knows a publisher that wants to hear all these stories and more.
Ja, har vi några förläggare där ute, så ta kontakt med Tim Russell. Thank you so much, and let's finish off, as I always do, up your bottom.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.